Welcome to a new edition of the Famous Interviews with Joe Domino series. On this episode, we talk with comedy programmer, executive director, and author Art Bell. His latest book is a memoir called Constant Comedy, How I Started Comedy Central and Lost My Sense of Humor. It tells the amazing story of how it all happened from idea through the Comedy Central's first 6 years when he was the senior programming and marketing executive. At his heart, he is a businessman, a visionary, and a lover of comedy who spent most of his career in television. He's originally from the Jersey Shore and grew up in a middle-class household in the late 50s and 60s with clear ambitions to become a famous scientist and to be funny. He also plays the piano and drums in that coveted jazz vein, and more books are to come. We cover quite a bit of coveted ground in this interview. Enjoy.
I'm good. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for taking a minute out today.
Oh, my pleasure.
You know, I kind of want to start off everything here with, I never thought I would get to this point where I would think that comedy would be in danger of the way our American society has become. But it almost seems like there's a level of sensitivity and even, do you sense that comedy is in some weird level of peril right now?
Not only do I sense it, I've talked to friends of mine in the comedy business, some stand-up comedians who we interviewed on a podcast I was doing. Yeah, it's a problem, and a lot of these comedians, especially the stand-up comedians, are really concerned that stand-up comedy, as it was known or has been known, is kind of going to die if this keeps up.
And that's a travesty. I mean, I even think about George Carlin, all the bits that he would do about, you know, those prophetic memoirs on American society, and it seemed like we used to have some level of skin where we could deal with it. And in your case, with Comedy Central, you know, I'm going to be 50 this year, and I remember when that came out, that network, it was so refreshing. There was so much good, and there were roasts, and there were things going on, and people loved it, and now everybody's sensitive. I don't know if COVID heightened that notion, but it's very strange to even hear you say that comedy is an endangered species.
Yeah, listen, you know, to be serious about this, comedy's not going to die out. Stand-up comics are really, there's enough stand-up comics out there who just say, I don't care. I'm going to do my act, and if people walk out or yell or scream or try and cancel me or whatever they do, I'm going to do my act. That's what I'm about. Stand-up comedy is important. You know, it allows the audience to see the world through a comedian's eyes and through that particular prism, and that does everybody a great service. I mean, you think about the contribution that women comedians made in the 90s, sort of explaining is the only word I can think of to America, what it was like to be a woman in America at that time. I mean, think of Sarah Silverman, for example. I mean, her stuff was pretty raw. Nobody was shouting her down as much as laughing and listening to a great extent. And I think that was, you know, a wonderful thing for women comics to be doing in the 90s. And they still do it. You know, you want to really give that up? You really want to give up the opportunity to see the world through the eyes of people who are not exactly like you? I don't think that's a good idea.
Bill Burr was coming to Kansas City a few months back, and I was reaching out to Starlight Theater to cover the show, and they immediately came back and said they are not granting any press passes at all, which I thought was strange, but I also find it very logical, too. I think there's a part of the journalistic world and people's interpretations that aren't even jiving with these cats anymore. It's become a place where you just got to be careful, like, who's going to be out there and who's going to interpret what you're doing.
Well, listen, it's part of the bigger, more general situation in America now with book bannings and the curriculums being assaulted, public school curriculums being assaulted, out of fear, I guess, out of concern that the possibility that students or people can be offended is something to be avoided. And I, you know, again, it almost makes no sense when you say it out loud. We should push ourselves to be offended. Our sensibilities are not perfectly fine-tuned from birth. You know, they evolve, you make choices, and one of the ways you make choices is you're exposed to a range of things that you can decide, well, that's too much for me or that's not enough for me. But when you start saying that's too much for everybody, that to me, again, crosses the line. Look, there are certainly lines that should not be crossed. I am not in favor of comedy any kind of comedy that encourages people to violence. And we have seen that in this country, where people are making jokes about minorities, and that results in violence, and that's bad.
Agreed. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Well, you know, speaking of the world being in a very strange and precarious place right now, before we get into your book, Constant Comedy, I want to go back in your life. Let's go to the beginnings. Talk to me a little bit about your childhood and how, you know, this world of comedy kind of became your destiny.
Well, as a kid, I was really fascinated by comedy. I started watching comedy on television when I was about 8 years old, and it was on weekly on the Ed Sullivan Show, which was on at 8 o'clock on Sunday. And that was a variety show that, you know, 30 million households tuned into every week. It was a big deal. And that's where I first saw Richard Pryor, and in his premiere performance, I believe, on television. He was like 20 years old. And I fell in love with these guys, these comedians, the Borscht Belt comedians like Alan King and Joan Rivers. And, you know, I thought, wow, what a powerful way to communicate with people when you can get not only me and my dad and my brothers laughing, but, you know, 30 million other households across the country and all at the same time. I mean, and I also understood that there was so much truth in what was being communicated. Richard Pryor, for example, in his first appearance, talked about being an African-American kid in Peoria and getting beat up on the playground. Now, it was a brilliantly funny routine, but in addition, it really kind of pointed out the difficulties that kids have on the playground and African-Americans have in general. So I thought it was, you know, I thought it was really interesting. And I went on from there to, you know, really kind of become a comedy nerd. I listened to all the George Carlin albums when they came out. Bill Cosby, you should excuse the expression. I mean, his albums were bestsellers, as you know, in the late 60s and mid 60s. Robert Klein later on. You know, those albums were really important to the way I was looking at the world at that time. And everybody, all my friends, everybody I knew was listening. A lot of people were trying to basically mimic the comedians, you know? I mean, it was, they found the comedy so powerful that they wanted to talk like that, you know? Around our house, we were all talking like George Carlin for about 2 years, which drove my parents crazy, as you can imagine. But that was, you know, that was how it was. When I got to high school, I got interested in satire, which is, you know, comedy plus a point of view in the hope of securing some change. I thought that was really interesting stuff, and I started a satirical underground newspaper in my high school. Yeah, I got in trouble. I thought it was important, and I found that I liked writing satire and ultimately comedy. So that's how I grew up. This was all on the Jersey Shore, by the way. That's where I grew up, and it was a great place to grow up.
Yeah, it's interesting. Those comedians that you mentioned, you know, the days of Don Rickles just kind of going up and just, he never really got political, and there was a lot of guys like that that didn't do it. But Richard Pryor and a lot of these other guys, and even George Carlin especially, really, they were putting comedy out there to change minds. That was a very interesting sea change that was happening, and I think that that's the thing that it's kind of the precursor to like Jon Stewart and all of that. Their commentary was really key to the comedy they were putting out as well.
Yeah, well, that predates them. That goes way back. I mean, Will Rogers in the 30s was, you know, he was a populist comedian, and he really talked about what was wrong in America during the Depression, and he was very, very famous. Mort Sahl, that was like the early 60s when he showed up. Again, a political comedian of the type that hadn't really been seen before. He was very intellectual, very smart, and very funny. And that was part of a tradition. And that tradition, you know, kind of continues today. Yes, the ultimate realization of that, I think, was Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, where he became not only the source of news for lots and lots of young people, but really kind of a force for reform and for change and for acknowledging what was going on in society, not only in a comedic way, but in a serious way.
You were initially wanting to become a scientist, and then, you know, you went the comedy route. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, kind of how that took off. You talked about Fiddler on the Roof and kind of going into the theater realm? How did all that kind of take off for you?
Well, you're hitting a lot of points here that are not necessarily related. I loved science when I was a kid. I mean, it was just another thing I got fascinated in. But by the time I got to high school, I was really more interested in writing and talking about going into journalism. When I went to college, I pretty much found the guys like me, you know, the people like me, there were women too, who were interested in, you know, comedy and entertainment. And I did end up in Fiddler on the Roof, which is the only legitimate, I say legitimate, half tongue-in-cheek, but the only real musical I was in, and I did sing and dance, and that was really an experience for me. But there was no way that was going to convince me to to go into musical theater. I wasn't that good. I mean, I probably pulled it off at that in the college performance, but college production. But I was kind of interested, or thought about, I guess, briefly. Because so many of my friends in college said, "Hey, we're going to Hollywood. You know, we're gonna get into the entertainment business. We're gonna write comedy." And even the friends of mine who, you know, I had one friend who was a very funny guy who I did some comedy with at school, and he said, "Hey, you know, maybe we should just do this. Maybe we should do this for a living." And I said, "Nah, it's not gonna work." And he ended up going into science, running a lab in Boston, and I ended up somewhere else completely. I took a job as an economist in Washington D.C. That was my first job out of college.
You know, when you did get into comedy, when you finally did, you know, find your calling, did it ever feel like a job for you?
Yes, absolutely. Listen, comedy is a business. It's not comedy is the way it's practiced in your dorm at 2 a.m. with your friends. It's a tough business. And that's one of the things that I brought out in my memoir about starting Comedy Central and about, you know, what the business of comedy and more generally the entertainment business is like. It's difficult. It's tough. And I'm sure I'm not the first person to mention that to you. I went from economics, you know, the journey from economics to comedy was not necessarily a straight line. I went back to business school in the hope of getting into the entertainment industry or going to work for a television channel. I did get a job at CBS after I got out of business school, which isn't exactly what I wanted to do. And then when I got there, I realized working at CBS, it was one of the big three networks, you know, and really kind of commanding a lot of audience in those days. Basic cable was just getting started. So working there was really like working at the post office. I mean, I was nowhere near the product. But I did get a call from HBO, someone, a friend of mine was there. And that was, you know, HBO in the mid-80s was like Netflix. You know, it was the hot happening future of television. And everybody wanted to work there. Now only 700 people or so could. So I was excited when they called, and what they wanted me for was to do econometric forecasting of subscribers. Now, that was about the last thing I wanted to do at HBO. But as my friend who called me said, you know, I'm one of the few people he ever heard of in the entertainment business who knew anything about econometric forecasting. And that's because I had done that in Washington. So that's how I got into HBO. And when I got to HBO, I had a more receptive audience when I started talking up my idea for a 24-hour comedy channel.
So how did that job progress for you? Did you do the same thing there throughout your history at HBO, or did it evolve into other avenues for you?
My calculus at the time was that, okay, I want to get closer to the product here, meaning television programming. I particularly like comedy. And if I really had my way, you know, we'd start a comedy channel here. And I really thought HBO was poised to do it. At the time, they were doing one-hour comedy specials with, you know, Robin Williams and Robert Klein and Whoopi Goldberg and Billy Crystal, you know, and everybody. And Sam Kinison, you know, guys like that who were really kind of too hot for television. I thought, hey, you know, who better to start a comedy channel than HBO? But the first couple of years I was at HBO, I spent doing forecasting and market analysis. And my calculus, as I started to say, was, okay, I'm in the right place, but I'm not doing the right job. However, I got to do the best possible job while I'm doing it, because I want to get noticed, and I don't want to be known as somebody who phones it in an attempt to get to another department. So I worked very, very hard on that, and it did, you know, it did exactly what I hoped it. It was a fairly high-profile project in the company because everybody was... The top executives were certainly fascinated by what what my take on subscriber forecasts were. So I did get a little profile at HBO, and then I moved to another department because somebody who had seen me give a presentation or something called and said, you know, I think you should, you know, I'd like to have you work here in new business development. Now, that sounded like the right place for me, at least much closer to the right place. At new business development, I worked on the new business that they were working on. You know, it's so funny. In so many companies, they have a department or something called new business development that really isn't dedicated to generating new businesses. It's really either kind of a sideline of the company so that they can say they're doing it, or in the case of HBO, it was like, okay, we have an idea for a new business. Let's make a department called new business development and then develop the new business there, which is exactly what happened. HBO was trying to create a clean HBO. You know, as you may not remember, HBO was famous for uncut movies and uncut comedy specials and all of that. And they found out that a lot of people who weren't subscribing to HBO weren't subscribing because they did not want want that kind of content, language or sex language or violence in their home. So HBO set out to capture that audience with a toned-down version of HBO. And my first day on the job working on this new channel, it was called Festival, by the way, I said to my boss, now, how are we going to sell an entertainment product by what it doesn't have, especially given that what it doesn't have is sex, violence, and bad language, which is a lot of what people are looking for, even if they don't say they're looking for it. Anyway, my boss told me not to say that anymore to anybody, and so I kept quiet. But Festival ultimately failed, mostly because, as you can see, it wasn't that great of a concept to begin with. But on top of that, Disney, which was then a children's channel, came flying at us as competition. They said, hey, we can play grown-up movies at night that are sort of family-friendly. Why don't we do that? And they did, and they, you know, basically kicked Festival's butt, and that was the end of that. My first look at competition, and it's been one of my major rules in business, never underestimate the competition. You don't always know where it's going to come from, but it's coming. You know, if you don't see it, it's coming. So that was a good lesson.
I mean, it's a lot like sports, too. You know, there's always 5, 10, 15, 20 people waiting to get that one position that somebody's out there doing right now. It's just the way, there's always a replacement waiting.
That's for sure. That's for absolutely sure. For sure. So that was how I ended up in new business development with absolutely nothing to do, which was, you know, really kind of the laboratory for me for creating what was first called Comedy Channel and then Comedy Central. I mean, I was just sitting around. They said, hey, you know, don't leave. We like you. We'll find something to do for you. As I pointed out, there was no interest in starting other businesses out of new business development at the time. So I just, you know, I was in my office trying to figure out what to do. And I decided, okay, I'm going to write up my idea for a Comedy Channel. And I did, and I, you know, did the financials and the description of where the programming would come from and what the audience was, you know, all the stuff you're supposed to do when you're contemplating a new business. And then I got the bright idea that I should really pitch this to somebody at HBO, seriously, which I hadn't done to that point. So I called up the office of the head of programming at HBO. Her name was Bridget, and she was a very powerful person at HBO, as you can imagine. And I kind of assumed she was a genius because, you know, that's what programmers are. They you know, they take the pulse of the audience and put on what they think is going to be great. So Bridget, you know, again, relatively small company, Bridget said, sure, you know, and I made an appointment and I went down and I sat down in her office and Bridget said, what can I do for you? And I said, I have an idea. I think HBO should start an alt comedy channel, 24/7 comedy channel. And Bridget said, stop right there. That's a terrible idea, and I'm going to tell you why. And she spent the next 15 minutes telling me why it was a terrible idea. And again, this pretty much makes up the first or second chapter of my book, was that meeting with Bridget, because she pointed out what were, you know, her take on the significant flaws. First of all, why would HBO risk its great reputation by putting out a comedy channel? Second of all, why would any comedian of any stature want to be on an all-comedy network? She said Billy Crystal would never be on an all-comedy network. Neither would Robin Williams or Whoopi, and their management would die before they'd let them be on it. So, you know, listen, I wasn't in the comedy business, Bridget was. She knew the comedy business. And so when she was saying these things to me, I took them seriously. She said, it's too expensive. Comedy's expensive. You're never going to pull this off. And she went on and on, and then she dismissed me. You know, she said, thanks for coming down. You know, you obviously don't know much about television or comedy, so have a nice day. And so I left. But as I say in the book, by the time I got to the elevator, I knew she was wrong. Somebody was going to start a comedy network. It just felt like it. Stand-up comedy was booming in the United States, and in New York especially. And as I said, HBO was the leader in uncut comedy on television. They had almost no competition. I say almost because they did have competition. There was a daily show called A&E at the Improv that showed a half hour or sometimes an hour of stand-up comedy, mostly unknown comedians who went on to become famous comedians, but unknown comedians every night at 7 o'clock. And that was getting a reputation. You know, I said to the people at HBO, you know, you're getting chased by A&E. You really want A&E to start a comedy network? I mean, they could do it. And that was, one of the ways that I got their attention ultimately, because nobody wants to get trumped by the competition.
So, you know, you hear stories all the time about the teacher that says, you're never going to amount to this, or you're never going to be able to do that. When you left that meeting, did that add more gasoline to the fire of you starting Comedy Central and getting this idea going?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. What it really did was it forced me to take a look at the reality of working at HBO. You know, I was relatively young. I was new in the business. I was, you know, I guess I wasn't quite 30. There were lots of entertainment companies out there. And I said, okay, if HBO is not going to do this, and basically I'm benched right now, I'm not doing anything, I'm going to work on my resume and I'm going to staple my comedy idea to my resume and see if I can get a job, A, that's interesting, and B, get MTV Networks or Universal Studios or somebody interested, you know, or CBS for that matter, interested in starting a comedy network. So that's what I did. But I never ended up sending any of them out because while I was working on it, my boss's boss came by my office and he stopped and he said, what are you working on? You got nothing to do. And I said, yeah, you're right about that. But I'm working on this idea I have. And he said, well, let me see. And I showed it to him. And he said, wow, Comedy Network. That's great. I said, yeah, you think so? And he said, yeah. He said, you know, the chairman of HBO should see this. I said, wow, I'd really love that. And he said, come on, let's go. We're going to go to his office right now. Now, I just want to point out that at that time, the chairman of HBO was a guy named Michael Fuchs, who had just 2 weeks earlier been named the most powerful man in Hollywood by the New York Times Magazine. I was probably the least powerful man in the entertainment industry at the time. So the whole idea of walking into Michael Fuchs' office unprepared, essentially, I mean, I had no presentation. My off-the-cuff pitch to Bridget didn't go very well, so I wasn't going to try that again. But my boss's boss, his name was Larry. Larry said, come on, we're going to go see Michael. And we did. And I pitched it to Michael. And he said, wow, that sounds kind of interesting. Why don't we explore that? Let's do some research. Let's do a demo tape. I'm going to team you up with some people in the comedy department. And that's how it got started.
So, you know, the one thing you did mention there at one point is that, you know, the perception of what comedy is versus the reality is very different. So for anybody listening to this, what is the reality of this business at the end of the day? I mean, is it things that people may not realize about the comedy business?
Well, the first thing I found out about the comedy business is that it's insular. You know, it's a club. You're either in the club or you're out of the club. If you're a comedy performer or writer or in the comedy business, meaning a manager, or in the case of the person I was paired up with, a programmer, he was Stu Smiley was his name, was the head of programming at comedy programming at HBO. And the first thing Stu said to me when he met me wasn't, hi, how you doing, or hey, cool idea. It was, the hell do you know about comedy? That's the first thing he said to me. And it was very clear that Stu was not about to take me under his wing and show me the ropes. I was very much an outsider. And I remained an outsider for quite some time, even though I was working very hard on trying to get this comedy network started with Stu and other people at that point. And it was hard. But the comedy business is, you know, as I said, it's a business. You have to pay your dues to get in it, which I hadn't at that point. It was kind of a rough and tumble business. Certainly the talent had a tough time with it. I mean, not everybody got famous. as you know, a lot of people try stand-up comedy and don't end up doing it for a living. It's hard. Or they want to become comedy writers, and that's a completely different area. But, you know, I know people in who are comedy writers, and that's, you know, that's also a competitive, tough business. And it's not just about, you know, laughing your brains out. It's really about meeting deadlines and writing something funny that the boss or the talent thinks is funny. You know, all these things, you know, when it gets to be a business, then there's a lot more at stake than just getting somebody to laugh.
On the current comedic landscape, who are you digging on now? Who are some comedians that you really either want to see or, you know, consume their comedy?
You know, I'm gonna say Gary Goldman is at the top. I don't have to go much further than that. I mean, I really think what he's doing is, first of all, in the great tradition of confessional comedy, of the type that Lenny Bruce was doing. You know, Gary talks about his depression. And if you haven't seen him or heard him, it's worth checking out. But he was depressed for a long time, and he's not the only comedian who was depressed for a long time, but it was very interesting to hear that story, and he was very forthright about it. On top of that, I think his stuff is brilliant. I think he's really, really something. So that's who I like.
So let's say you have a dream tonight, and you run into the younger version of yourself, and you can give your younger version a piece of advice based on the wisdom that you've accumulated over all these years. What would you tell your younger version?
I would tell my younger version to do exactly the same things I did, but not to be so intense or anxious about it. I mean, I think a lot of the fun I could have been having, I didn't have because I took things so seriously, and I felt the pressure. I never felt pressure in a job before or since the way I did at Comedy, because Comedy Central, you know, I pitched it. It was my idea. A lot of what I wanted it to be is what it became. And there were a lot of people depending on me, and it was pretty intense. I just wish I had enjoyed it a little bit more. That said, you know, I had lots of fun. I met a lot of great and very creative people. And, you know, I don't want you to think I didn't have a good time, because I did. It was a lot of fun and a lot of laughs. But it was, you know, as I said, it was fraught. It was business. And I got called on the carpet a lot of times. I went to work every day the first day after Comedy launched, expecting that they'd shut it down because it wasn't successful, and that I'd get fired because I certainly wasn't making it successful. I was trying like hell, but it was, and people don't really know this about it, it was a disaster after launch. And I got called on the carpet by Michael Fuchs about 3 months in. And what he said to me was, you know, Art, it took a Comedy Channel to make me lose my sense of humor, which I kind of borrowed from my subtitle of my memoir, which is, you know, my memoir is called Constant Comedy, How I Started Comedy Central and Lost My Sense of Humor. Obviously it's not true. I didn't lose my sense of humor, but there were moments of terror, you know, no other way to put it.
Well, you know, the one thing over this last couple of years with living through COVID is there's been a lot of time for self-reflection, quarantine, all of that. What did you learn about yourself over this time that's going to make you stronger as you get out and kind of resume life? You know, things are kind of opening up, you know, the entertainment world's waking up. How have you changed? How are you going to be better now as we open up?
I'm at the end of my career, not at the beginning. I have some successes under my belt. I mean, after Comedy, I went to Court TV. I became the president of Court TV. We turned that around, sold it for a lot of money, none of which was mine. But, I mean, the company was sold to Turner Networks for a lot of money. And it was a very successful undertaking. And it really taught me that, proved to myself at that point, that all the things I had to learn at Comedy Central, I walked into my next job with. And nobody questioned my bona fides at that point. Nobody said, hey, this guy doesn't know anything about programming. Even though, you know, that's what they first said at Comedy. So I, you know, that was a real journey for me. And I'd worked at several other networks, and I went on to work in other, you know, entertainment or media types of jobs. But, you know, I really developed some confidence that I knew what I was doing, essentially.
So what would you like your legacy to be? As you said, you're kind of on the tail end of things here. You've done a lot of wonderful things. But ultimately, when someone sits back, they hear your name, they think about what you've done in your life. What would you want that takeaway to be?
Well, first and foremost, I started Comedy Central, and I think that was a great, you know, it's 31 years old. It was 30 years old last year when I published the book. It's had an impact on so many people and on the industry, the comedy industry, and it really is something I'm proud of. I look in the rearview mirror and see it, and I just think, wow, that was something that I did that was good. Now, of course, I always say this when I'm talking about it. I started it, I worked hard on it for 8 years to make it successful. Then I left. There were hundreds and hundreds of people, and at this point, thousands and thousands of people who've made that channel successful. I don't take credit for all of it. But it is something that I think about a lot, that I did. The other thing is writing, which I've come to later in life. I mean, I've always written stuff, but I wrote my memoir. The challenge there is I wanted to be a good writer. I didn't want people to read the book and say, it's kind of sloppily written or it's not well written. So I worked very hard on that, took classes in writing memoir at Sarah Lawrence Writing Institute. And that was successful. And I'm now working on a novel. I've gotten several short stories published. And I'm really kind of in a second round here for me. I love writing. I think it's great fun. Luckily, I don't have to make a living at it, but I can see the appeal of people who try to make a living at it. So I'm going to keep writing. I also, you know, I play music, and that keeps me out of trouble. To a certain extent, you know, all the things I've done at this point, you do gain a certain amount of confidence and a certain amount of humility. I mean, I play jazz drums. I've been doing that for 12 years, and I know I'm never going to be the great jazz drummer. Just not. You know, I'm a pretty good musician. I can play the drums. I play jazz piano, same thing. But I enjoy it so much. And I work hard at it. And I'm good enough. Same with my writing. You know, I'm pretty good. And I acknowledge that to myself. And that's the important thing, that I consider myself good and that I enjoy what I'm doing. So that's, you know, again, that's not exactly the way it was at the beginning of my career, but that's how I feel now.
You know, you touched a nerve with me because that my bread and butter is being a jazz radio guy. So I'm curious, if we get off the phone, the Jazz DeLorean pulls up in front of your house, you can punch in the digits and go anywhere and see anybody, and even meet that person. Where are you going? Who are you going to see and meet?
Interesting. I'd say Monk, actually. I'd say Thelonious Monk, because nobody played piano like him, and he was just such a genius. You know, I say Thelonious Monk, there's only about 150 people come to mind, but yes, for one, that's the one. I think he would be fascinating to talk to. I never saw him live. Although I think I was around when he died somewhere. But anyway, he's really one of a kind in jazz. Now, you want to go down the list? I mean, Miles Davis would be fun, although he probably wouldn't talk.
Yeah, well, and you may not want him to talk.
Right.
He may come after you.
Bill Evans, Ray Charles, who I did see live. I've seen a lot of guys live.
Well, that's luckily. The thing. Who did you see live that you remember that was just stellar, that you loved?
Well, as a drummer, I don't know if anybody knows this person, but Billy Higgins, who was one of the great drummers. When I saw him play drums live, I was in a club. I thought, that's what I want to do. This guy looks like he's dancing and having the best time. I want to play drums. And again, I didn't start playing drums till 10 or 12 years ago. I'd been playing piano most of my life, but that was that moment. Other people, geez, you know, there's just, you know, so many people I saw. I did see Ray Charles live, again, at a club, so I was sitting, like, right on top of the Rayettes. that was a treat, you know, to be up that close. Who else have I saw Max Roach. I saw, I did not see Bill Evans. I saw Dave McKenna, who's a pianist you may or may not know, who's died. I don't know. You're making me think harder than I was planning to think about all the people.
Yeah.
I make a list. Nobody's asked me that before. Who have you seen? Who of the greats have you seen? I saw Dizzy. I did not see Miles. I saw the bassist. What's his name? Charles Mingus, when I was in college.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And that was, again, at a small club on campus. I was at the University of Michigan at the time. And he was a mean old guy, man.
He was mean to
the band, mean to the audience, but he was, wow, what a musician, what a performance. So, yeah, listen, I feel lucky to have seen the guys I've seen, and I'm sad that I didn't see more. I saw Sarah Vaughan. I saw Sarah Vaughan in the club. She was that. I had a smile on my face the entire performance. That was a first. You know, it was just so ridiculously wonderful.
You know, I interviewed John Coltrane's daughter Michelle. She's a singer, and she was telling me a story when she moved with her mom Alice to the West Coast, and she saw Sarah Vaughan riding her bike, and I've never gotten that image out of my mind. And it was one of those really smiley moments, like Sarah Vaughan's on a bike, you know. I mean, you just see her as this jazz legend icon, and she's just out in Long Beach riding a bike, you know, and it was awesome. It was a great story.
Well, you know, it's interesting. All those guys, you know, they were geniuses, and they're brilliant, and they're great performers, but they were human, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, Duke Ellington had a house in where was it? In Brooklyn somewhere, right? And, you know, he lived out there and did stuff people in Brooklyn did, you know, and that's, you shouldn't forget that.
Yeah, for sure. So let's say you get approached to make your book into a movie, and they sit down and they ask you, who's going to play you? Who's going to be the actor that's going to play you? Who is that?
You know, actually, I had some people interested in possibly doing a movie, but it, you know, like so many movie ideas, it didn't go anywhere. I don't know. A young Dustin Hoffman, how's that? let me think. Of today's performers, that's tough. Because I'm trying to think of performers who are young that I know by name at this point. It's not as many as it used to be. If I come up with something, I'll write you a note. But
totally, that's the
casting was never my forte. And I know that is the great hobby of America, is to cast stuff. You know, especially books. Who should play this person or that person?
Everyone has a perception of you. Your family, your friends, your fans. But ultimately, you live your life. You have a perception of yourself. Who do you think you are?
You know, I'm kind of a loner a little bit. And I think COVID may be more so. I like being with people, but it's not like food to me. It's not a necessity. If I don't see anybody for 3 weeks, well, I mean, my wife. But if I didn't see anybody other than my wife for 3 weeks, that wouldn't be a tragedy. Well, there's my kids, too. But you know what I'm saying. I am happy to be in a room writing or playing the piano all by myself, listening to myself or talking to myself or making myself laugh with my writing. And that's, to me, that's a good time.
I like it, man. Hey, Art, thank you for opening up. Thanks for taking a minute out. Before we get off here, let's get to the good business here. Tell everybody where they can get your book and anything related to what you're doing to promote your book.
The first stop should be Amazon. I mean, if you're not going to find it in your local bookstore, and it is in bookstores, but not every one of them. Amazon has it. So go to Amazon, and you can buy it. It's in hardcover. It's in audiobook, and which I narrate, by the way. It's in electronic, and it's coming out in paperback in December. So that's that. The other stop you should make is my website, artbellwriter.com. There's some other writing I've done that I put up there, links to get my book and to get the audiobook. And also, I did a podcast, I mentioned that, with a friend of mine who was at comedy from the very beginning as well, named Vinny Favalli. He went on to work for Letterman for 15 years, so he knows a lot about comedy. And we're still pals, and we decided to do a podcast, limited series podcast, for the 30th anniversary, and we talked to a lot of people who were at Comedy Channel. That's what it was called when it was launched, on day one, and what their careers became. Some of them are extremely successful. Actually, most of them. And became writers, and one gal became the head of Paramount Pictures, Gail Berman. And, you know, so that was the start for a lot of people. And we had a great time doing it. So you can learn about my podcast. It's also called Constant Comedy. Yeah, that's what I encourage people to do. Constant Comedy, How I Started Comedy Central and Lost My Sense of Humor. It's a memoir. It's very personal. It's a great insight into what makes the entertainment industry work or not work.
Beautiful. And this has been a great insight into you and your life. Art, thanks for taking a minute out today. Good luck with the book and the future. It's been great to get to know you.
Thanks, Joe. Likewise.
Thanks for tuning in to another famous interview with Joe Domino, where we cover the world of art, literature, and music around the globe. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit the YouTube Neon Jazz channel. And for everything Joe Domino, go to joedomino.com. And when you're there, you can find our Patreon link and everything else. And for everything art-related, go to www.artbellwriter.com. Until next time.